Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I'm joined by Samantha Lamas, behavioral researcher at Morningstar. At Morningstar, Samantha works as part of a team that does original research, creates content, and develops tools to help advisors work with clients in a more behaviorally informed manner. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we were having a little conversation before. We were talking about some of our friends at Morningstar, and I know I'm supposed to love all of my children equally, but of all the guests I've had on, one of the standouts and one that I refer people to a lot, point people to a lot, was my conversation with your colleague, Sarah Newcomb, absolutely one of my all-time favorites. Now, you co-authored a paper with her titled The Complicated Art of Making Things Simple, that looks at common behavioral science dilemmas that advisors face and suggests a framework for thinking about how to intervene. So you had a figure in there that I thought was brilliant and presented some really some dilemmas that I think people don't always think through, and presented some ways in which almost behavioral biases could work in conflicting ways or bring someone to a crossroads. Could you talk about some of those complications that can come when we try to make things simple?
Yeah, of course. So first off, Sarah Newcomb is amazing. I'm not surprised you had a great conversation with her. And for anyone who's listening now, I do recommend going back and hearing her episode, or even just reading her work. Her book, Loaded, I think is a must read for anyone who has to deal with money, which is most of us. So with that, in that piece that we co-wrote, we tried to map out those three common dilemmas that advisors face. So those were issues with lack of knowledge, issue with a shortcut, either with for good or ill, and also issues with willpower. So I'll try to briefly explain that those graphics in the paper, even though those graphics were great. So when it comes to knowledge, a lot of the times advisors have to face clients who may not be financial experts. they're probably in your office in the first place because of that, which can leave them vulnerable either to financial mistakes, to falling prey to bad advice, or even just being prone to choice paralysis. So as they're Googling a question and they get pages and pages of results, it's easy to just get stuck on doing nothing or taking a shortcut along the way, et cetera. So in this case, advisors really have to choose between giving a client all the details that they need and they know are available, versus just giving them an answer and running with it. The other dilemma that we kind of outlined was that of shortcuts. So this has to do with heuristics and biases. So we all take shortcuts when we make decisions, and a lot of them are actually for the better. But there are times when they lead us to the wrong conclusions, the wrong actions, and that's when we call them biases. And advisors kind of have to balance this idea that shortcuts are extremely useful and many people should probably use more of them, with this idea that, you know, sometimes you do need a more long, drawn out conclusion or analysis to come to the right conclusion. And then there's, of course, willpower. So change is very hard and people are constantly struggling with behavior change, and finance is no different. And advisors have to recognize moments where good choice architecture should be implemented to help clients stick to their plan and hold on to their, you know, their guns when things get difficult. So one of the things we tried to do in the paper was sort of map out what advisors should do when facing these dilemmas. So the way we think about it, the advisor should always try to start off with choice architecture or a helpful nudge. So for example, if a client is trying to save more, is there a way we can automate it so that the next time the person gets a raise, their savings rate automatically goes up? So these quick fixes that require very little thought or self-control from the client. So next is the use of shortcuts. So biases get all the press. Everyone's interested in the quirks of our mind and the way they lead us astray. But our shortcuts, the heuristics that we take, are actually extremely useful, especially in circumstances where we aren't subject matter experts. The future is a bit hazy, and we may not have all the resources that we need to make the best decision. So for a lot of us, this perfectly explains financial decisions. And it shows that shortcuts can be extremely easy. So things like always save up for big purchases, or always pay the minimum, or always pay more than the minimum when dealing with credit card debt, et cetera. So there are instances where advisors can give their clients a quick shortcut to follow when they're faced with a decision. So if a shortcut isn't appropriate, then that's when we get into more intensive behavioral coaching. So things like helping your client extend their time horizon through future visualization exercises, or using a pre-commitment device to rein in unwanted behavior during market volatility. So it goes from this spectrum of quick and easy fixes all the way down to more intensive coaching sort of work that advisors should do.
It's a great way to think about it, I think, because I think so often we go sort of paradoxically for the hardest one first, right? Instead of teaching a lengthy lesson on the benefits of rebalancing, we should just automate rebalancing client portfolios, right? They don't need to know what's going on behind the scenes necessarily for us to have a positive behavioral outcome. So in automation, start with automation, move to shortcuts, and then bring out kind of the big guns, the education, the coaching, only as necessary. I love that framework, because a lot of these things are so tricky. We know that people don't like to be commanded, right? And we know that people sort of balk at being told what to do. But we also know that they come to us for advice, but we also know that too much education can be overwhelming in its own right. So I think it's a brilliant paper, one that I hope people will check out and revisit my conversation with Dr. Sarah. So when I was going through your research, you were good enough to point me to a couple of your pieces, and I noticed that one of them dropped almost on the very day the world fell apart. This piece was released on March 13th of 2020, which is, I think, just about a day or two after everything began to shut down. So it may not have gotten the love that it deserved. Yeah. So I want to
not intended.
there was some other stuff going on at the time. So we're going to revisit that now and talk about this piece, which was all about how psychological shortcuts can potentially lead to gender bias in asset allocation and the provision of financial advice. Can you talk to us about the type of mental shortcuts that might lead us to misserve women?
Sure. And just as the context, I've always been interested in how gender impacts the advisor-client relationship, especially as we're seeing this shift where more and more women are, you know, taking charge of their finances or the finances of their family, or women are coming into money due to inheritances or that wealth transfer, et cetera. So there is existing research which finds that women in some cases do feel misunderstood by their advisors. And you see this in the stats where, for example, 62% of women versus 44% of men are willing to consider switching advisors. You also see this in academia. So there's a great study by Mulanathan, and I'm probably terribly mispronounced that name, but definitely recommend it, where they ran an audit study where participants were instructed to go to financial advisors, and all the participants had the exact same financial and personal situations. The only thing that was different was that they had different demographic characteristics. So they had men, women, older, younger, et cetera. And then they were instructed to ask the advisor for advice. And what they found was that female investors were given different advice just based on the fact that they were female. So for example, they were asked about their personal and financial situations less. They were suggested to have more liquidity, less international exposure, and fewer actively managed funds. And this was solely because of the fact that they were women. There was nothing else different about their financial situation. So in our research, we tried to dive a little or focus more on one aspect of the advisor decision-making process. And specifically, that was setting the asset allocation based on specific details. So we gave advisors these prospective client scenarios. It was all in a digital way. So it wasn't in person. We weren't able to do a field study where everything was the same except the gender of the prospective client. And then we asked them to make a recommendation. So in this digital scenario, we actually didn't find any bias, which is actually quite encouraging. But the only caveat was that we skipped over a few steps of the advisor decision-making process. Specifically, we kind of skipped over that initial conversation step and the information gathering step, which based on existing research kind of points to those could be the areas where biases are creeping in.
So where in that information gathering do you think the bias creeps in? You know, I think there is a widespread belief, and I'd be interested for you to speak to this empirically. I think there is a widely held belief in the industry that there are salient differences between men and women on with respect to risk tolerance. So if you have any information there, I'd be interested to hear you speak to it. And then if you could tell us where in that information gathering process are we going wrong and kind of what can we do about it?
Sure. And one of the pieces, I think it actually came out from Morningstar, but I don't know if it was ever publicized externally. So Morningstar does a lot of work on RTQs, so risk tolerance questionnaires, and they had this data set of risk tolerance questionnaire results from past couple of years, plenty of other people or plenty of men, women, et cetera. And they did find a slight difference in risk tolerance where women were slightly less risk tolerant than men. But even that, even for studies like that, you have to argue that that's on an average scale. When you look at a specific person, which is the whole point of personalization, I mean, that person could have been on any point of that spectrum. And then as a side note, we did a separate study on interest in ESG, sustainable investing specifically, which is another common stereotype in investing where women and younger individuals are supposedly more interested in ESG investing. And in that study, we actually didn't find a significant difference between men, women, young, old, et cetera. So I think those common stereotypes of certain genders or demographics being more risk tolerant or more interested in ESG, et cetera, I think we have to be careful with those, especially as personalization comes into the picture where everyone wants specific advice for them, not the average them.
Yeah. One of the things I try and emphasize is that even where group differences do exist on average, and it sounds like they may not exist here in a meaningful way, but even where they do exist on average, what's true of a group in general isn't necessarily true of any person in specific. And that's why we undertake the personalization process. That's why we give the RTQ. So even where you might think there are some group differences, it always pays to dive deeper. So one of the things you talked about was using this common interviewing technique of a structured interview to try and root out bias in the information gathering process. Can you tell us how we can sort of systematize that information gathering process with respect to giving more egalitarian advice?
Yes. So in a hiring context, this is called structured interviewing, and it's actually a pretty drawn out process where you have a set hiring committee and you come together and decide what skills are necessary for a job, what questions can tease out these skills, what's a rating scale, for example, what does a 1-point answer look like versus a 5-point answer, et cetera. And then as you're interviewing candidates, you ask each candidate that same set of questions and rate their answers on that same scale. The way we see it is that when it comes to advising, we know that having that, you know, fluid, friendly conversation is very important, but there has to be a point in those initial conversations where you treat it like a data gathering exercise, where you have a set of questions where you ask each prospective client and you make sure that you collect all the information, based on those questions, no matter who the client is, which can be seen as one of the downfalls in the audit study where women were asked less about their financial situation versus men. So of course they weren't given that same proper advice, which can be easily avoided just by having a checklist of questions that you have to go through with every client.
Yeah. So keeping it, if you will, sort of semi-structured, right? There's a core of questions that there's a core of information that must be gathered in order for you to effectively personalize, give the right sort of advice, but then not to be afraid, I think, to keep it organic as well and to follow conversations where they lead. So it doesn't, I think, feel so sterile, but you want to make sure you're also checking those boxes, because when I think there's no rigor or no form to the process, that's where our natural tendency and some of those heuristics can turn into the biases that we all want to avoid.
Agreed. There has to be some sort of balance in the two.
Yeah. So a topic that I'm always a little surprised about the amount of controversy it generates is around trying to quantify advisor value. So we're going to steer clear of that controversy today and instead talk about discrepancies between where clients perceive value in working with an advisor and where financial advisors themselves perceive to be adding value. Morningstar did a study that showed that there was some really big gaps between where we as an industry think we're doing the most and where clients are perceiving that value. This is a study I've cited a ton of times, so thank you, in some of my personal work. And I'd be interested to have you share some of the most fascinating findings from that work.
Yes. So that was a fun piece overall. I think we're hoping to redo it soon as times have changed and things like that. But just for context, in that piece, we did exactly that. We asked investors what they value in a financial advisor. And then we asked advisors what they think investors value in a financial advisor. And then we sort of compared the two. So this allowed us to see not only the priorities of investors, but also really see how well advisors actually know investors. So there were a few areas of both concordance and discordance between the two average rankings. So on the positive side, both groups understood the importance of financial goals. So they both ranked very high on their list. So both groups realized that helping a client reach their financial goals is of utmost importance. But there were also a few discrepancies, as you mentioned. So one of those being maximizing returns. So advisors understand that that maximizing returns might not be the most important thing shouldn't be the most important thing for investors, especially in moments where it kind of goes against their goals. So for example, if you're close to the retirement, maybe not throw everything into equity. Mm-hmm. But investors didn't quite agree. So I think they ranked it actually number 4 on their list. And we think this could be a lasting misconception of investors where they still see advisors as stock pickers or, you know, get rich quick sort of schemes versus really what advisors are, which are sources of unbiased holistic advice, really. And I think one of the most alarming attributes in where it was ranked was the attribute that had to do with behavioral coaching. Mm-hmm. So from existing research, I'm sure there's some controversy there, but behavioral coaching is pretty regularly ranked high in terms of the most impactful thing advisors can do for their clients. So realistically, it should be high on a client's list. But what we found that it was ranked dead last. There was nothing even close to it. Investors do not value it at all. And our explanation here is that investors just don't understand the role of their emotions and their behaviors on their financial lives. And it's just an information gap that advisors will have to fill over time.
Is this a marketing problem for the industry? When I think about this, even the word behavioral coaching, it feels kind of clinical. It feels like there's an identified patient and it's the client and they're broken and we're going to fix them. It feels kind of condescending. Like, is this Is this for people like you and I, we need to do a better job of sort of breaking down behavioral coaching and calling something that's a little more palatable so that clients will better appreciate the value that it adds?
Probably. So we actually did a follow-up study where we tested out the impact of having different phrases to describe behavioral coaching. So in our original, we described it as helps me stay in control of my emotions, which, like you said, probably sounds a little pedantic, you know, probably something people just don't understand. And in our follow-up study, we tested out 5 different versions, and 3 of the 5 actually did better. So these other 3, I can read them out loud. So helps me make financial decisions with a cool head. So it's a more colloquial way of explaining it. Another one was helps me avoid common behavioral mistakes. So the word common there to sort of show that it's something that we all suffer from, you know, it's not you're the problem. It's, you know, we all kind of have these mental hiccups. The other one that we used was helps protect my portfolios from excessive emotional reactions, e.g. panic selling during downturns. So specifically providing an example. So these 3 different versions, they were ranked somewhere near the middle of a person's ranking. So it moved them up quite a lot, not completely number one, but still there was a difference. And we think that maybe these different ways of describing behavioral coaching just resonated more with individuals. So giving an example, saying that it's something that we all share, maybe just didn't rub people the wrong way like our original phrasing did.
I still think it's hard to get away from this return mindset. You know, I mean, even in my clinical work, I spent some years as a clinical psychologist, and inevitably the first thing that everyone wanted was sort of the pill to make it all go away. And it feels like returns serve an analogous function there, right? Like you crank up my returns so hot that it doesn't matter what I do. I'm just going to reach my goals. It is a little bit of a magic wand scenario in either case, I think. So I don't know that behavior is ever going to climb the ladder to be perceived by clients in the same way that we understand it to be effective. But it is heartening to know that if we can do some things to soften the language, to help folks understand that this is something that we're all susceptible to, it is heartening to know that it can be a little better recognized for being as valuable as it is.
Agreed. Yes, it moved the needle at least. At least it's not so far at last that it was falling off the page of our ranking diagram.
Absolutely. So the last one I wanted to ask, the last piece I wanted to focus on was the one where you talked about mining for goals. And this is a topic that's near and dear to me because I think something that surprises folks outside of behavioral science is just how murky our access is to things like our own motivations, our drives, our goals. People think that we would have relatively easy access to these types of things. But once we understand this, we understand that the process of determining client goals is a little more complicated than just asking, you know, hey, where do you want to go? And you and your teammates have done some interesting research around this. What did you find that can help us better prime conversations around mining for goals?
Yes. I think the idea that we don't know our, you know, top 3 most important financial goals, it is surprising for people, but if you really think about it, it shouldn't be too surprising because this question by itself, you know, what are your 30-year overarching financial goals? It's quite a loaded question. And that's because it involves our emotions, because it involves the money that we've worked really hard to raise, as well as our emotional relationship with money, which is complex and its own monster on its own. It forces us to forecast our future desires, which human beings are not good at. I think that's fair to say. And it involves all this math and numbers that many people just aren't comfortable with. So when a person is asked this question, we find that our minds automatically turn to our biases. So for example, availability bias, we go with what's top of mind. If your client just went to a great housewarming party, maybe the first thing that comes to their head is, oh, I want to buy a home, even though they love to travel and maybe an RV is a better fit for them, for, as an example. So in our research, what we tried to do was develop a fairly simple three-step process that forced individuals to slow down that decision-making process. So step one was to ask the person to write down their top three financial goals right off the top of their heads. So this is what is traditionally done in the industry today. For us, it was really just that first step of getting people in the right mindset, just helping them begin that brainstorming stage. And then we took them to step two. And in step two, we asked individuals to go through this master list of investment goals that we collected from industry articles, academia, media, et cetera. And we asked them to go through each of the options on that master list, either checking off the ones they thought were important, but just forgot to mention the first time around, or crossing off the ones that just didn't resonate with them. And really what this allowed people to do was systematically understand their own preferences in a much more controlled, calm state of mind, but as well as splitting up the generative from the evaluative process. So when you're asked this question, you have to think up goals that might be important, and then you have to evaluate them to see if they're the right goals for you. Mm. In our process, we kind of cut step one out and let people focus more on step two and really think about whether that goal is right for them. So after the individual went through this entire list, we asked them to write down their top three goals again. And if that master list, if this process really had no impact, a person's initial goals and their final goals should be exactly the same. That's not what we found. Instead, we found that up to 70% of people change at least one of their top three goals after going through this very simple exercise.
That's such a fascinating finding, because so much in behavioral science is just ease of retrieval, right? So many of the things that we see manifesting themselves, these behaviors emerge because they're easy, right? They're top of mind. You just went to the house party. So yeah, I want a house. Like, you know, I just went to my kid's school play, so I want to send them to college, whatever, you know, whatever it is, whatever recency bias may be impacting us. So I love that iterative process, and it's fascinating to me. I wouldn't have guessed a number that high. 70% seems high to me, but that's incredible to see how profound that change is. You know, it's just all of this is a testament to me of the power of having smart folks like yourself work on technology teams, because we can make changes to technology that seem so innocuous, right? I mean, a piece of technology may seem so straightforward and so self-evident, but a small tweak like that can have such an enormous change. Whoever's listening to this, if you don't have some behaviorally minded folks on your tech team, I think you're leaving value on the table, and you can better serve your clients by greater thoughtfulness around these things. Fascinating finding. So my absolute last question to you, behavioral science is a world where sometimes simple changes, small changes can have profound impact. So I just would ask you to kind of think back on all your research, all you've learned about this. And for the listeners, if you could leave them with one simple behavioral change, tweak, modification that would have an outsized impact on either their personal or financial well-being, what's your one small tip to make life a little better?
So for this one, I think I have to take it back to the principles of behavioral change. And I'm sure you've gotten this one before, but my tip would be to pay attention to your environment. And that's not just what's immediately around you, but that's also, you know, who you surround yourself with, what you're watching on TV, you know, what you're subscribing to on your computer, or who you're following on social media, because social media is so huge these days. But overall, like who we compare ourselves to. So to give a very superficial example, if you want to avoid overspending on new clothes, maybe unfollow those fashion-focused influencers and maybe follow some thrifters instead. So you're still filling the need of buying clothes, but maybe in a more budget-friendly way. So really just depending on your willpower alone for behavior change is really just a recipe for disaster. I think we all recognize that. And we have to acknowledge the role of our environment and making sure we fill the need without ignoring it completely.
It's a brilliant suggestion. I think we're not thoughtful enough about our reference classes, right? The people with whom we compare ourselves. You know, I was on a podcast just about 2 hours ago on someone else's podcast, and they asked me what thing about behavioral truth I had most changed my mind about. And I said, look, before I started studying human nature, I was a much bigger believer in sort of expansive free will than I am now. And one of the things that I believe now is just that we're highly, highly influenced by the places where we put ourselves, the things we put in our heads, and the people we surround ourselves with. That I feel like most of us are capable of very great good and very great evil, if you want to kind of go there, and that our decisions are usually as good or as bad as the environment is. So I think it's a powerful suggestion. I think we all want to believe that we have more willpower than we actually do. And a lot of us would be better served by just making sure we're putting ourselves around the right people, filling our heads with the right ideas, and surrounding ourselves with the right reference class. So go follow those thrift accounts on IG and leave all the Lambo and mansion accounts aside. Samantha, thank you for being here today. The research you and your team are doing is absolutely incredible. It's helping the whole industry, and we're so appreciative for it. If people want to read about some of the articles we've talked about today, if they want to follow you and your work, where can they find you?
Yes. So, of course, being from Morningstar, a lot of our work is on Morningstar.com. We write a lot of articles for there pretty regularly. But when it comes to social, Twitter is probably the best contact. So my Twitter handle is Samantha Lamas 4. Because Samantha Lamas 1, 2, and 3 were taken. So you can follow me there.
Okay, perfect. Samantha Lamas 4, but number 1 to listeners of Standard Deviation. So thank you. Thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.